Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Glad to have you with us. We're going to live tweet this hour, so join us at KUOW. You are joining Bill Radke. Did I say my name, Joni?
Yeah,
I did. Okay, I'm Bill. Joni is former columnist at the Seattle Times and host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Hi, Joni.
Hi.
Ron Sims, former deputy secretary at Department of Housing and Urban Development, and that was in Washington, D.C., former King County executive and King County councilman, too. Ron, welcome back.
It's great to be on KUOW.
Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General and King County Council member. Always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. I like the UW part of KUOW.
You do?
Yeah, I'm just saying.
It's because he was student body president.
He was student body president while I was there. I've seen Rob McKenna signs my entire adult life.
That's true. And Mr. Sims had his own presidency.
At Central Washington.
There you go.
I also am a WSU regent, so go Cougs.
There you go.
But I think Rob should take those signs down now, don't you?
Right on.
Okay, well, let's talk about being in political office in positions of responsibility. May Day is coming on Monday, the annual demonstration for workers' rights or immigrants' rights or both. As for how to demonstrate, Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant says that she can't control what demonstrators do, but she wouldn't rule out blocking the airport or a highway, not a freeway, she said. Now, on KUOW's Facebook page, Chrissy wrote to Sawant to say, quote, "Blocking traffic blocks emergency vehicles. It's rude and selfish. It's not going to get people to side with your cause. March and protest peacefully, but stay off the busy streets so people can get to where they need to go." Now, Sawant says she also worries about blocked emergency vehicles, but she says when you consider the disruption that is already happening, like parents getting detained and deported, well, some disruption on May Day is worth it.
Disrupting business as usual in a peaceful and nonviolent manner is what history has shown works. You know, we would not have any black rights, women rights, rights for immigrants, rights for workers, unless working people were willing to disrupt the profit-making business as usual. I would see May Day and May 1st as a beginning of an empowered and peaceful resistance.
Ron Sims, you've done some demonstrating in your day, and you don't feel the same way.
I don't. I think that it's important. I like demonstrations. My parents demonstrated in an era where there were no civil rights laws and no protections, and they were leading the civil rights issues in Spokane with a lot of demonstrators. And the issue with us with the law enforcement was, we're going to demonstrate. How can we do that safely for everyone? And you win a lot of friends when you do that. When I was in college, we demonstrated every day. It was great.
Wonderful. Every day.
It seemed that way. And it was the same rule. It wasn't an issue about whether we were going to demonstrate. It was how we could demonstrate, have our voices heard through demonstrations, at the same time work with the local officials so that we knew whether it was emergency vehicles or transportation safety. There's a whole series of things that you want to know. But we were going to make our statement, and we made our statement. So,
but some Councilmember Sawant is saying, yes, nonviolent, peaceful.
No, that's not what she said. When she says that you don't know what's going to happen. No, when you organize a demonstration, you have to know how to be most effective. Because when you demonstrate, it's not making a point. Demonstrations are designed to change minds. And so if you want to, you know, make a point, then do anything. I am not interested in demonstrations that are not designed to change minds. The Women's March was perfect here because it was done within the constraints of the law enforcement on what streets to use, how to get from Judkins Park to the Seattle Center. Huge, huge, beautiful, wonderful, spectacular. Those are the most effective demonstrations you can have.
Joni, you've covered a few demonstrations.
I've covered a few. Well, let's consider the fact that there's extra heat this year because of all the resistance to Donald Trump. And let's consider the fact that sometimes when you listen to Councilmember Sawant, you can't tell if you're listening to a council member or a protester. And I think at some point she's going to have to decide which is it.
Why?
Because, well, the reason is because here you have an elected official not ruling out, to use the language, lawbreaking, closing the airport or closing a highway, not a freeway, is lawbreaking. How does that help the cause? It seems to me that it's very
maybe it brings the cause into clarity that wow, a lawmaker is saying.
I think the opposite. I think if something goes wrong, it's going to end up being in her corner, on her tab. I think it's very irresponsible what she said. She should be talking only about peaceful protest only.
Rob?
I am concerned. I mean, I think it's a dangerous situation if people try to crowd onto a freeway on a freeway on-ramp. It's not safe for the demonstrators, nor is it necessary. We have very successful peaceful demonstrations here all the time. The Seattle police have developed a fairly sophisticated approach to handling them. May Day is always a special case because the parades are sometimes infiltrated by anarchists who want to break things. Mm-hmm. And the police have a technique for anticipating dealing with that as well. It just isn't necessary to risk the demonstrators or the people traveling on the freeway by encouraging them to rush onto.
Well, she did rule out freeway. Is that an important difference? What if it's not a freeway on ramp? It's a highway. It's a busy street. Does it matter?
You know, I think that the demonstration route needs to be planned so the police can provide appropriate safety measures. You can block off side streets, for example. Someone who's in a hurry and glancing at their text message messages as they race down the street, doesn't see the crowd walking up the street, it's a recipe for tragedy. And so working with the police who want you to be able to demonstrate and want to facilitate that is the sensible thing to do, I think.
Ron, did you never see disruption beyond plans with the police? You never saw that work in your demonstrating?
I saw it work once really well. It was called Selma. But remember, they were told they couldn't demonstrate at all. And they said, no, we are going to demonstrate. You are not going to stop us. So there are times if somebody were to say, don't do it at all, then you'd have to say, well, I'm sorry, we are going to do that. And Selma was important. And it was important to me as a kid because it was the first time I saw people who were my age or a little older all of a sudden going to the streets. But the power of it was being told you can't. And they said, it is our right. So I would look and say, no, I don't want a demonstration where a person who has the right to demonstrate decides to make it even more difficult and challenging for other people. You have to persuade minds. That's what demonstrations are for. Not to make a point, not to thump your chest, not to say I'm important. They are designed to change minds.
What if the shoe were on the other foot? What if this was someone from the right, a Milo Yiannopoulos urging people to break the law? What would the council members say then? I mean, you have to consider how this resonates with people who are absorbing the information about the protest.
What about, okay, so let's take emergency vehicles out of it. What about blocking off access to SeaTac Airport? That's mighty inconvenient.
There's just no reason to do it to make the point. That doesn't sell your case. Okay. That's not helpful.
Well, what do you want May Day to be?
I would love to see thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and I don't care what their issues are, gathering and saying, you know, this is our day to express our discomfort, our distaste, our dislike for some policies that are coming out of Washington, D.C. by this president and unfortunately by this Congress, whether it involves health care or the environment or the use of the military. For people to be able to gather, find that harmony among views and interests and be able to say, enough is enough. It's enough. That's what I want to hear. And I want other people who are watching it to say, you know, they're making some good points. I want people who are not walking that day, who may be watching it or reading it in the paper, to say, they made some good points.
Yeah, you know, politics aside, it's incredibly important to our country historically and in the future that people get out and demonstrate when they feel a passion for an issue. I'm co-chairing a continuing legal education program today on civil liberties, and we had an opening presentation on what's happening to civil liberties across the globe. It's not a pretty picture. More and more countries are clamping down on the ability of people to peaceably assemble, to demonstrate, from Russia to Africa to South Asia. It's very troubling. And America and Americans need to stand up and remind the world that we believe in these principles of free speech, freedom to peaceably assemble, and to make our views known.
So finally, Councilmember Sawant has been arguably a very successful politician, attention getter to issues. She's trying to reframe things. She's trying to move what is moderate and centrist and what's okay. Are you generally, do you think she's wrongheaded or fighting the good fight?
I think you can fight the good fight without promoting conflict, you know, open conflict like she's promoting with the highways, not the freeways.
Yeah. And in general, do you think she's...
You know, I don't mind her...
Taken seriously, getting good work done, or...
I think there's a lot of protest in her daily work. And I think that, you know, being a council member is more complicated than that and harder than that.
Okay. Okay. Any other quick words before we move on? Nobody wants to say more?
Mayday's a great day to work in the garden, I'm just saying.
Working in the garden? Okay. So join Rob McKenna in his garden on May Day, also known as International Workers' Day. There is a permitted march around 10 in the morning from downtown to Judkins Park, and another from there to Seattle Center around noon or 1. And, of course, as Rob pointed out, you never know what kind of property damage or police confrontations may come. This is KUOW's Week in Review. If you're hollering at your radio right now, you can do more. You can add to the conversation. What's your experience with these topics? We are live tweeting the show at KUOW. More to come in just a moment. KUOW's Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Ron Sims, and Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. Lawyers for Seattle Mayor Ed Murray are objecting to the tactics of his accuser's lawyer. Murray's accused of sexual abuse, which he denies. He says the claims are false and politically motivated. Murray's attorney says his accuser's attorney has violated professional standards to grab media attention. The public knows about a description of the mayor's anatomy that the mayor says has been proven false by a doctor. We know a bit about a mysterious incident at the mayor's house in which the mayor says all he did was call the police to report a suspicious person he didn't know. And we know that the accuser knows Murray's telephone number and the layout of his old apartment, which the mayor's spokesman says can be found online in 90 seconds. Rob McKenna, as a former attorney general, are you troubled by how the accuser's lawyer has managed the case, or does this seem like standard practice?
Well, I am troubled by it, and it's something that I saw a lot as attorney general because Mayor Murray's lawyer and his partners at the law firm frequently sued the state of Washington, and DSHS, for example, and they used many of the same tactics involving manipulation of the press, attempts to gain press attention, all to put pressure on the folks who ultimately had to make the decisions in those cases about whether to fight or settle. And those were elected officials and appointed officials in the governor's office and in the Office of Risk Management. And I think that those tactics were clearly aimed at putting public and therefore political pressure on the governor's office and her agencies to force them to settle and to settle on favorable terms with that law firm.
Is that rule-breaking? Is that unethical? Is that grabbing media attention? What's your take?
It can be unethical because you're attempting to influence the judicial process, and the judicial process is supposed to be a neutral fact-finding process in which you apply the law to facts as presented by both sides. And it's an adversarial process, so all the facts are supposed to be presented to the judge and to the jury. So we have a system in place which is not supposed to be tilted by popular or populist pressure.
Yeah, I think this. We have to all acknowledge that this is a really, really tough time for the city of Seattle and for the participants involved. And that said, I think that this lawyer has shown himself. He's really revealed himself with some of the things that happened this week. He's revealed himself as a showboater, as someone who's perhaps watching too much lawyer TV. You know, I've talked to some of the folks who were at the mayor's house that evening. We're talking about this moment where he called the police. You know, that was right after Orlando.
The shooting at the nightclub?
Yeah, thank you. Folks were a little jittery. And all they did was
call. A gay nightclub, by the way. And are you saying that's a factor?
I'm saying that folks were a little jittery. That was the night of around the time of Pride celebrations here in Seattle. You know, and the main thing about this, the reason it looks really showboaty, for lack of a better word, is the fact that it has absolutely nothing to do with the case. What is the connection? Nothing. It's designed to demean the mayor and the office. And I think we should all be concerned about that.
Any comment, Ron?
No, my wife is, I think, pretty average, and she found the whole thing to be pretty distasteful. She's mad at both councils. I mean, she doesn't think this is, it's become theatrical rather than an issue of you know, people filing, making claims, how the campaign, how the claims are going to be dispatched. I mean, she just finds it really repulsive. And so when it's in the paper, she doesn't read it. She is not interested in it. She just says, her view of Seattle was that we were always going to be a place where learned people would have differences. But there was a way for us to express our issues. If you're going to go to court, and then there was a way to go to court. And she just thinks this is a breakdown. If you're going to sue somebody, sue them. But and she's also, quite irritated with the journalism. I mean, there was one part in the first story, she said, why do I need to know this? Mm. Might have been an issue of proof, but she just says, well, I don't need to know this.
That could have been generic, is what a lot of folks are saying, that the idea that they had this private information could have been generic, and it also would have enabled, if there are other people, to come forward. So they sort of blew that by putting that in there.
You know, a week ago we were talking about new challengers in the mayoral race, and this week it seemed closer to normal, right? There were news conferences and that's it. The deadline to run is 3 weeks away. Do you have any thoughts on what new challengers come, or whether we just this is it?
It's called polling. That's what's going on this week. People are polling to see how this is all resonating with the public. And so folks need to get more information is what I'm hearing. Two polls. I know of two active polls in the field.
You mean two new potential challengers doing their polling?
No. Oh. Not on behalf of new challengers. Okay. On behalf of groups that want to figure out where they want to go, and candidates, wherever they may be.
I don't know, but I think Rob and I would tell you 3 weeks is an eternity in this business, and that the countdown may be 3 weeks. But if you have a really strong candidate, if that's determined through polling, that you have one candidate that's very strong, they can come in on the very last day and file. Norm Rice filed at 4 o'clock for mayor. 4 o'clock. Nobody knew who was going to run. He walked into the records and elections and said, I'm going to run for mayor.
Didn't Gene Godden do the same thing running for city council?
Yeah.
Last minute, last
It's not uncommon at all.
Yeah.
Some people I've heard want a Republican Bill Bryant to run for Seattle mayor. Could a Republican be a Seattle mayor?
It's possible that in a crowded primary, someone who's a Republican, recognizing it's a nonpartisan race, so you wouldn't have the partisan label on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Someone in a crowded enough primary conceivably could get through, sure. And to the general, do you then win the general? It would be very hard. We have seen deep blue areas elect Republicans. Camden, New Jersey did so several years ago. But it would be very hard unless the other person running were somehow so far out there that people felt we'll go with the moderate Republican.
So is it fair to say, Rob McKenna, that you're considering a run for mayor of Seattle?
Most unfair.
That would be unfair to characterize it that way?
I mean, really? Who would want that job? I mean, aside from the guys who already got it and the 15 people who filed for it. Holy smoke. What are you trying to do to me here, Radke?
Ron Sims, mayor of Seattle?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm free at last. Free at last. God Almighty, I'm free at last.
My guests are Mayor Joni Balter, mayor-to-be, and are you also ruling on a run?
Yeah, ruling.
Okay.
Out.
Okay. This just in.
Did have a nice ring to it, though. Yeah.
It does.
Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, Ron Sims, Bill Radke, back with more of the Week in Review. Don't go away. It's KUOW's Week in Review with the former Deputy Secretary at HUD, Housing and Urban Development. And that was under President Obama, right?
Wasn't he great?
Who, Ron Sims? He was good, that guy. Former King County Executive, King County Council Member. We have the former State Attorney General, Rob McKenna, and King County Council Member 2, and Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, Seattle Channel. And we are talking the Week in Review. Rob McKenna, you live in Bellevue?
Yes.
Right. Does Seattle disgust you?
Not at all. I think that a healthy, vibrant Seattle is key to the entire region.
You don't want to divorce a King County Seattle split?
Well, that is tempting, I have to say. From time to time, my friends in East King County become very frustrated, not unlike people in Eastern Washington who become frustrated by the political dominance of the west side of the state. Mm-hmm. But look, it's not practical to start breaking up counties and fracturing.
Let me tell folks why I'm asking. I talked to a Republican state senator from Auburn, Phil Fortunato, about his new bill to let state counties redefine their borders. And he says ideas like minimum wage and safe consumption, so safe injection sites, these are problems that originate from Seattle, shouldn't be allowed to affect the rest of King County. And he feels places like Renton and Kent would be better off if they were allowed to leave the city, split from the city.
They started off with their needle exchange thing. They started off now they want to do free heroin. At one point in time, it's been like 20 years ago, wanted to hire prostitutes to teach other prostitutes how to put condoms on. You know, I mean, they want to have, by the time they're done, they're going to have a $25 minimum wage or $100,000 minimum wage. So, I mean, they're just, the homelessness, they've now become the homeless capital of the state, basically. You know, trying to end homelessness. Now, you can't even drive down I-5 without passing tents on the side of the road and garbage and people sleeping everywhere. You know, I mean, they basically ruined the Emerald City. Part of the problem is it's not only what they're doing within King County, but it's their influence on the rest of the county. That's more of the problem.
Well, King County has its own council and county executive. Isn't your problem with them?
Well, that's true. But when you look at the makeup of the council, because of the high density in Seattle, you have a significant number of the 9 members on the council are actually Seattle-based. So Seattle has a disproportionate influence on the rest of the county.
Before I go to the former county executive and to Joni, I just Bellevue resident Rob McKenna. Is there anything in there that's fair in your view that Seattle is? Why does Seattle tugging King County around and its progressiveness?
It's because of the concept of one person, one vote.
Okay.
So it's I understand the political frustration, but that the solution is not to fragment this particular county. I don't think.
Former King County executive, does the county get pulled around by Seattle in some tragic way?
In the old days, no, we didn't. King County is one of the largest metropolitan governments in the United States.
And I 12th think largest.
And I think all of us as members took great pride in being King County. Mm. And the cities were junior districts by law and under the Constitution. And many of them were miffed that we treated them that way, including Seattle. But I think that to say that somehow or other the county council's decisions are being based upon ignoring everybody else and only being concerned about Seattle is just not true. The other issue is the viability. There was a lot of efforts when Rob and I were on the council, people that wanted to, succeed and create their own counties. But county governments are mandated by law to provide a whole series of regional services, mental health, alcohol, and drugs. And when you start going through the depth of those, they did not have the local money to provide the services that counties are required to provide. Seattle, on the other hand, is what we call an economic engine. It puts a lot of money, and it allowed us to redistribute. And there is a relationship among council members where the redistribution of money is kind of accepted because we want the whole of the county to be healthy.
So Ron Sims referred to it, but everybody remembers the proposal for Cedar County. This was back in the 90s. The Supreme Court said no. And Phil is in the legislature.
Remind us what Cedar County would have been.
It was a separate county to be formed in East King County because at the time folks were upset with growth management largely, but some of these other concerns were mentioned as well. The Supreme Court said, this is the job of the legislature. And by the way, the legislature hasn't been interested in doing this for a long time. The last county was formed in 1911, Ponderay County. So it's not something we do just because you're mad at certain things that you see on your drive into Seattle. And also another very important thing here.
By the way, you are a pond of information. That was very interesting. Oh. Go on.
Whatever. But
all right.
All right. But now to the merits of this not so good idea, and that is, think about what Seattle taxpayers provide for the rest of the county. I mean, they pay a lot of money for services that go out to places like Auburn. Medic One would be a great example of that. You know, so whenever these things come up, and they do come up from time to time, you know, there was a proposal also in Snohomish County for a breakaway county. Whenever these things come up, you always end up sort of, let's add up all the money that is raised within the big city and how does it benefit the larger county. And also, you know, look, people in Seattle benefit from having rural areas. It's good for us. It's good for us to have other ways of living to be part of who we are.
By the way, I want to mention, because you heard in that audio the state senator saying Seattle's giving out free heroin. There are no plans to give out free heroin in Seattle. That's different from a supervised injection site, which we'll talk about in a moment. Also, minimum wage, not actually $100,000 an hour.
That's what I thought I'd heard, but I wasn't 100% sure on that one, yeah.
All right, any more comments on county-city divorces before we move on?
If it's $100,000 an hour, I might start working again.
You are running for mayor. You are running for
mayor. Lured out of retirement.
Lured back into the workforce.
Look, most of what King County does is regional, right? The biggest part of the budgets are wastewater treatment, metro transit, or what we used to call it, the transit system, and then public health. And, you know, there's a reason we provide those at the county level, and they're provided at the county level all across the state.
But, you know, even though there might have been partisan differences at times, geographic differences, I don't think any of us who've served in county government ever saw ourselves as being, we saw ourselves as the county government, the regional government with regional responsibilities. And you may have tug and pulls, but we all still believe we were part of a regional government. That was why you wanted to go to work, because you were dealing with problems that were not specific to a given city. You were looking at the things that were actually going to determine or actually determining our larger quality of life. And that was really important to many of us.
Let's talk about one of the Seattle abominations that Senator Fortunato complains about, the idea of safe injection or safe use sites where users would be allowed to use illegal drugs under the supervision of medical staff and professionals who can help with addiction. A Bothell City Council member wants to put that to a vote. Joshua Freed has proposed a citizen initiative to ban supervised drug consumption sites from King County. Joni, how do you think King County would vote on that?
You know, I don't think I can predict that. I can tell you that when I first heard about the safe injection sites, I was torn. You know, I thought it was like, oh my gosh, I don't want to promote this. But
it's
also
first in the country. It's happening in Vancouver, BC.
Right. But I, you know, I don't want to like be promoting more people to be addicted. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I wasn't sure what to say about that. But then the more I read, and I really do think when I don't know something, I should trust the experts on this. And the experts are saying that this is actually a way to save lives and make people safer in general. And so my thought was, well, you know, I'm really not an expert in how this goes, and I think I should listen to these folks who have really studied it and have studied the Vancouver situation and who think that it'll make not only the people who are addicted safer, but the people who are threatened and feel endangered by this.
Rob, do you think safe use sites will save lives and make people safer?
It's possible that some of the people who use them will survive the injection and not overdose. As I understand the way it works, they're going to bring in their own heroin, though, right? The city is not providing it to them, so there is a risk of overdose because people don't know what they're using. Many times, it's not like you have FDA approved heroin that you know the exact potency of it.
Especially in modern times, right. Fentanyl stuff gets in there.
So this has two concerns for me. Number one is if someone does start to overdose because they brought in heroin that was very potent, is it responsibility of the city then to revive them? And maybe it is. Maybe you just have the medic standing by and that's fine. But I wonder sometimes about the liability of the city for facilitating drug use that's obviously highly illegal. And the second thing, a concern I have, is broader. And I think this is what bothers a lot of people. It's that when the city sponsors a safe injection site, in some way it normalizes the idea of consuming heroin. It's like, well, you're going to do it anyway. We might as well give you a place to do it safely. And it normalizes it. And people are really bothered by that because heroin is extremely dangerous. And it's not something that people should be using. It's highly addictive. And if the city's doing this, even with the noble purpose of saving lives, I think a lot of people are troubled by the message that it sends that, well, maybe this is okay after all.
Would you be a no vote?
Yes.
Meaning ban these safe-use sites,
yes,
if it came to your,
there are other
to
ways
your ballot.
To deal with the problem, the most important of which is to provide more drug treatment. We clearly do not have enough of that.
And if you knew that drug treatment wasn't coming along, would it matter?
I would vote for a measure to expand drug treatment and mental health treatment in our county if I were given the opportunity. I would vote for that over increased funding for the arts, for example, which the county executive is proposing.
Okay. Former executive, Mr. Sims?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have mixed emotions about it. I'm probably one of the few people in my age group that never smoked marijuana. I just never did.
So just all protest, no marijuana, right? That was
all my friends, except for the secondhand smoke.
Yeah, the cloud was enough.
But really, I was never interested in it. Although I supported its legalization, which stunned my kids, who said, "Here's a non-marijuana smoker supporting it." Mm-hmm. Tim Hill, Cynthia Sullivan, and I, when we were on the Board of Public Health, when it was only three members, supported needle exchange. And it was very interesting, the people who came down that needle exchange program, because many of them were business people. They were in suits. They were not in jeans. They were not street people. And at that time, it proved people were, you know, yelling and screaming at us, "You're encouraging drug use." We said we're supporting a public health issue, which is we want dirty needles put away, and we gave people clean needles. On safe injection, I have the same sense that If a person's going to be safer as a public health issue and a safe injection site, that's important. But I also believe that, like on needle exchange, we wanted some transitions. We wanted some people who we finally knew and met and knew their names, and that we could move them into services. And so if you're going to integrate services, that is, you're going to catch people. They may come into that facility eight times, but the ninth time they're in, all of a sudden it sinks in. Do you want to live a life like this? And you can get them into services. That's important to me.
Meeting addiction treatment.
If you can get, yeah. So if there's a pathway, not just come here and, you know, take your drug safely, but if it is formatted so that when that person finally says, I'm tired of this, I'm done with this," all of a sudden you have a component that can grab them. That would be important, and it would make it worthwhile.
Rob, were you one of those people who opposed safe needle exchange and came around? Some people have.
I don't recall being confronted with that issue as a policymaker. I think that the difference there is that we've been very concerned about the spread of HIV, and we know that sharing dirty needles is one of the ways HIV was spreading. So I think that tips the scales in favor of having a needle exchange program.
Okay. A King County voter initiative, again, to ban safe injection sites could land on your November ballot. And you mentioned, Rob, your concern was normalizing heroin use. Well, what about marijuana, which is legal in Washington state, but how normal should it be? That's our next topic, because state lawmakers just passed new limits on what roadside pot billboards can look like. Just the shop's name, logo, location, type of business it is. No pictures of marijuana plants, no pictures of brownies, no more billboards like the one for the Tacoma store, Clear Choice Cannabis, which includes a picture of a cat along with the words, "I'm so high, right, meow." Idea being,
oh, help
see,
us.
You were entertained.
Oh.
You might be a customer. You might smoke pot for the first time, Ron, because you
not off
so
of that
tickled.
Billboard. Uh-uh. No.
The concern is that some of these things make marijuana attractive to children. Does that cat and caption seem childlike? Child attracting?
I think it's a dumb phrase and a dumb billboard, and it violates, you know, everything that our state was trying to do when it legalized marijuana, which was to not make it attractive to kids or just cats. Give me a break.
It's not a cartoon cat. It's just a,
it's,
you know,
not,
you've seen,
it's
the
not
cat
a,
captions.
It's not a camel named Joe Cannabis. For example.
Well, there you go. For example.
Yes. People are going to use their phones. And they're going to go to a browser, and they're going to say marijuana store. And so, you know, you're not going to be able to discourage people from finding where they want to go buy their marijuana, because and then they're going to be rating services as to who has the best marijuana, because some of that's coming up as well. So I think that it's try as they might to say that a billboard is the most effective way to discourage marijuana use. if you want marijuana, you'll simply go to your phones, use a browser, and you'll have a tremendous selection presented to you.
Would you put any limits on what a marijuana billboard can look like?
I actually am, ironically, you know, as a, I like freedom of expression. I think that that should not be, I've seen racist billboards as well, and as much as I wanted to actually detonate them, I just, you know, when I was a kid, I remember seeing them. And so I just believe that our country has to be very careful about what we're willing to constrain.
Having said that, of course, we already prohibit billboards with tobacco on them. And tobacco is another legal product. And no one's saying it should be criminalized. But at the same time, you know, again, it's about messaging, and young people are particularly vulnerable to messages. I'm a veteran of the tobacco wars, you know, I would co-chair our tobacco committee at the National Association of AGs for 3 years, served on it for 8, and it was because we knew that the tobacco companies were targeting young people to build brand loyalty. Long before they were of legal age to smoke, and certainly after they turned 18. At some point, as the production and sale of marijuana becomes more corporatized, which is inevitable in my view, you're going to see the same logic apply, that they're going to be trying to win over young consumers and build that brand loyalty. So there's an actual logic behind limiting and in some cases prohibiting tobacco advertising, and that's the best reason I can think of for applying that, you know, those kinds of restrictions to marijuana as well.
So let's review some of the history of the law in our state. Once it was passed, there was something called the Cole Memorandum, issued by the U.S. Attorney General, which allowed the pot experiment to proceed in Washington and Colorado. But the first rule of that in the Cole Memorandum was preventing the distribution of marijuana to minors. And so what did we do about that? On many things, as the regulations were being formulated, edibles. You cannot have gummy bears. That's one idea. You can't have packaging that's attractive to children. You know, you have these very difficult to get into packages for the marijuana itself. The idea was always to make sure that you weren't trying to sell marijuana to minors. That was the whole point. And so many of the steps, many of the regulations do that. So I think the billboard, by the way, this just isn't a very exciting billboard, except we all got a good laugh out of it.
Well, some supporters of legal marijuana agree that we don't want to put a target on our backs when the federal government is considering cracking down on this. It's just that there's some gray area, right, between gummy bears and cartoons on the one hand, and no pictures of marijuana leaves. And in fact, this legislation bans marijuana sign spinners, people on the sidewalk spinning the signs around, which is, you know, some people don't want it normalized, but it is legal, and that's advertising. So aren't we in a gray area?
Yeah, it is a gray area. You know, we made a decision about liquor. You know, I remember moving to the Midwest to go to law school and being surprised by the ubiquitous liquor signs in the drugstore at the corner CVS, for example. I thought it was, you know, aesthetically, I thought it was kind of repugnant when I was going in to buy toothpaste. And in our state, we didn't allow that, right? Because we required liquor to be sold from stores. As an electorate, we're allowed to change the law. And we did so with liquor, and we've now legalized marijuana. But that doesn't mean we give up our ability to regulate how it's advertised, how it's communicated, particularly when we're concerned about kids. And I vividly recall in the debates over marijuana legalization in our state, the proponents saying, oh, but we're going to have lots of safeguards. This is not, we're going to make sure kids don't use this stuff. And now here we are.
That was one of the promises, right? And absolutely, you know, we promised that we wouldn't, that we would be the most regulated state. Folks are coming here from all over, apparently, to study how we put together our highly regulated industry. We're known for that. And you know, it's not such a big deal if there's a cat on a billboard, although I think I'd rather not. We should stick to the principles that we adopted when we decided to be the big experiment.
Okay. Yes, final word, Ron?
No, my issue actually is I'd like to have fewer stores.
Fewer marijuana stores. A limit on the number of
shops. You're
just
popping up all over the place. And, you know, the people holding the signs, all of a sudden you say, how did that store make it? I mean, my sense is that a lot of people got permits, and I just, it, it goes back to my saying it's okay to make it legal, but I'm not actually wanting it to be a widespread use. I just think there's just far too many permits that were granted for people to sell. I know it sounds a little conservative, but I get marijuana store fatigued. How's that?
There's the tension. Legal, normal. The legislature, again, has passed these tweaks to marijuana laws, including some new rules for what can and can't show up on pot billboards. Coming up on KOW's Week in Review, how much would you pay for a ride in the new Seattle waterfront tunnel, and how come we can't form an evacuation plan in the event of a North Korean nuclear attack? Stay tuned. You're listening to KOW's Week in Review. Ron Sims, Joni Balter, Rob McKenna. I'm Bill Radke, and I know that you listen to a lot of KOW, but do you really listen? Because you have a chance to prove it. At the Neptune Theater on May 24th, I'm going to be hosting KOW's news quiz with the Jeopardy champion, Ken Jennings, and celebrity contestants Lindy West, Sherman Alexie, Luke Burbank, and you, KOW's News Quiz, the Neptune Theater, May 24th. That's a Wednesday. You go to KOW.org for tickets and then show up to our news quiz, and you can turn all your public radio love and listening into the respect and admiration of hundreds of strangers. And if we're doing our jobs right, you're going to nail this.
It's Lindy West month in Seattle because she's on Civic Cocktail May 3rd. Sorry
hey.
For the shameless.
How about that?
Yeah.
Well, have her plug the show at the Neptune Theater, will you?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll do it.
KOW's Week in Review now. On with the news. The Seattle Waterfront Tunnel is dug. It's being built. And maybe it's going to cost more to drive it than you thought. The plan was $1.25 per trip in rush hour, otherwise a buck. Now the State Transportation Department says that might not be enough. Maybe a dollar on nights and weekends, $1.50 weekdays outside of rush hour, $1.75 in morning rush, $2.50 for the evening commute. Because 99's more clogged at evening rush, I assume. I didn't know that.
I think simplicity is your friend on something like this. You don't want people going, oh my gosh, which one is it? Should I divert and take 99 or not? So I think two numbers might be the right way to go. I don't have the exact number. I've always hated this part of the Highway 99 project because I knew that would be complicated to figure out how are we going to do this. But maybe two numbers, one for peak and one for off peak. I mean, what is, people aren't going to remember, oh, it's morning commute. No, it's evening commute. What to do?
Well, you can get it on your smartphone now. I mean, I can.
Yeah,
see
but you're not allowed to look at your smartphone when this
opens.
Before
you get in your car.
All right.
But you know, we wrestled with this issue, as Ron will well recall, when we were talking about what to do about the waterfront after the 2001 earthquake. It became extremely urgent, and you know, there were two main reasons we decided collectively that we needed a tunnel instead of a new elevated structure or just an arterial. The first one that was important to me was that I became convinced that we couldn't build a new elevated structure that would withstand an earthquake. It just was not technically feasible to do it given the ground and given the Seattle earthquake fault. And the second reason was that there was no way to replace the current elevated structure with another one without shutting down that whole corridor for years, which, as we saw during that earthquake, when our friend Greg Nichols literally walked to the courthouse from West Seattle because it was faster than taking the bus or driving.
I remember that.
That wasn't an option. But then there was the issue of cost. This is a very expensive project. We knew it would be expensive. And so tolling came into the picture very early on. What sets this corridor apart is how short it is. We usually don't slap a toll on something that's how long? 2 miles? Less than 2 miles long? So that always bothered me from a practical standpoint.
Why? What's the big deal about a mile versus...
Because it's so tempting for people to avoid it by diverting off onto the surface streets.
I see. And that is that's a crucial issue, right?
Truly. Because, you know, we had the experience with 520. We knew that some people would move over from 520 onto I-90 to avoid the toll. We estimated it to be about 20%. I think that's about what it has been. That's not that much.
An I-90 could handle it.
Right, well, yes, although, man, I'm using it every day. It's getting pretty rugged out there. Mm. In any case, those two bridges are far enough apart that a lot of people don't bother. 80% of the people don't bother to try to go down to I-90. They stick with 520. Mm-hmm. With 99, you've got all those surface streets plus I-5 tempting you to avoid.
I-5, that wide open expanse.
Yeah, except yeah. It's not open, yeah. And generally
so anyway,
it isn't.
That's the history, and that's the reason. I'm not surprised at all that they're now wrestling with the question of whether enough revenue will be produced. And you can see why the toll is so small, because it's a short distance you're traveling, so yeah. Charging $5 would be, you know, outrageous. But at the same time, they've had to keep it low in order to hope that people won't, you know, divert away from it.
I-5, she calls. Yes, Ron Sims.
I've always thought there was going to be a toll on the tunnel. Anytime you knew you had a set amount of money to work with, and the minute we went over it, I said they're going to toll.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, because one of the things that we've assumed in this country is in urban areas that we're never going to have tolls. Secretary Peters, who worked for President Bush, came out here a lot, and her position was that urban areas were going to have tolls on their freeways and their highways. And everybody first said, oh, that's just a Republican. When President Obama was in place, same thing. You look at the numbers and you say, you're going to have tolls. So I don't think this toll is particularly unusual. It is going to be. I have one of those things on my car, so I don't have to get a photograph saying I didn't pay. And they'll have one of those machines, I'm sure, in the tunnels, so that says, well, you were here at this time. Yeah. Here's your photo. Here's the payment that you owe us.
Even the ground can't protect you from those sensors, huh?
They can't. So
here's my question.
Nothing gets built anymore unless you're going to pay for it.
So the question I have is, the tolls have to be high enough to pay for the tunnel, but low enough that people use the tunnel instead of surface streets or the beautiful I-5. My question is, we arguably avoided a boondoggle when Bertha actually finished the job, though it was still over time and over budget. What are the odds we see the tunnel as a boondoggle because it's expensive and underused? Like, do you think we'll be happy with this thing once we have it, after all we've been through?
I do. We have lots of facilities that were way over budget. The I-90 floating bridge comes to mind. And it's not uncommon for public projects to end up over budget. But it's an essential corridor. We can't function without it. We experimented with that after the Ash Wednesday earthquake in 2000, or the Nisqually earthquake in 2001, and we realized our downtown does not function without that corridor open.
And say it's simply because of the hourglass shape of the city. It is real, and folks have been wrestling with this for a very long time, for decades in Seattle. It's hard to go north-south in the city. It's getting harder to go east-west, too, but it's very hard to go north-south without something like that roadway.
Imagine trying to evacuate this city if something really awful happened. Shall we go make that our final topic on the Week in Review?
I'm just digging the segue. Very nice.
Thank you.
Cue the sirens.
All right. Well, someday North Korea reportedly wants to be able to hit Seattle with a missile. What are we going to do about it? Well, here's what we can't do about it. Seattle Times reports Washington State is not allowed to make plans to evacuate people in the event of a nuclear attack. The former legislator who wrote the law says it was meant to be to set a peaceful example. Rob McKenna, you ran for governor. What do you think of this law?
I can't make sense of it. I mean, it literally prohibits our emergency planners from planning or building plans for evacuation in the event of a threatened nuclear attack. And there's no question it would be very hard to evacuate our area, but having no plan at all, because somehow not having a plan makes us look more peaceable, looks like the worst example of unilateral disarmament I can think of.
Well, the former Democratic lawmaker, Dick Nelson, who wrote this, says if Seattle were attacked, the odds of survival are so low that a preparation plan would be moot anyway.
Well, you know, this week, the Japanese...
That's a cheery thought, by the way.
The Japanese folks issued their plan in case North Korea lobs one in their direction. And it was very upsetting. It said you basically have 10 minutes to get to a stronger building. And sort of implied, they didn't say this, and sort of good luck with that. Good luck with the whole thing. That is not a strategy. And this law is really silly and should be changed.
It's a 34-year-old law.
Well, time for a rewrite.
It's a head shaker. The interstate system was created as a way of getting out of large metropolitan areas and moving in. And the idea that somehow people haven't planned for it, it's news to me, because on the county side, when we looked at all kinds of emergencies, we developed evacuation plans. I didn't know there was a law that to keep us from doing that. But I can tell you,
you are in trouble now.
I broke the law.
Statute of limitations is run on that, Ron. It's okay.
We always ignored.
You were in on it too, weren't you?
I was. We're both in the clear now.
Yeah. I mean, there are plans. We want people to be out of harm's way, whether it's earthquakes, whether it is. We want people out of harm's way, and you've got to control that, because if I'm in Seattle and there's a missile coming and I can get across I-90 bridge, which is probably going to be impossible, or across 520, which is also going to be impossible, if I can get north, if I can get any place other than a target zone, I'm going to be in my car and moving, along with all the millions of other people that will probably be in some traffic jam. But there are going to be movements in play by law enforcement and by the military to ensure that people are out of harm's way as much as we can do that.
By the way, we are supposedly a target because of our military bases. You got Joint Base Lewis McChord, Naval Base Kitsap, Bangor Submarine Base, and we've got Boeing and Amazon and Microsoft. Supposedly we're a luscious target, and North Korea might be able to hit us in, the experts say, 1 to 3 years. How much do you worry about a North Korean attack? Because I can remember worrying about the Ruskies. I forget how you said that, but you know, Armageddon pointed at us. How much do you worry?
You have to worry. I mean, this is a regime that is highly paranoid, and the normal constraints that would keep Russia and the United States from attacking each other may apply here. Some believe that, as the Plowshares People organization believes, that North Korea is just as deterred as Russia would have been, or USSR would have been. I'm just not sure that's true here. First of all, I don't know that we're dealing with someone who's in his right mind. And secondly, we've seen dictators with their backs to the wall before say, fine, burn them all. I think that this is a different situation.
So two narcissistic, insecure guys with bad haircuts and nukes, what could go wrong, right?
How much do you trust Trump to handle this? Any more or less than anybody else?
The Chinese are going to take care of it.
Yeah?
They're
North not Korea, worried.
North Korea, not almost.
North Korea is their greatest threat. They don't want the reason why my... There are things that China will simply not allow. If North Korea gets the capacity, I think our time is short already. I mean, I think that the issue will be how intruding they can be into North Korea, but it is not in their economic interest, or social interest, or their military interest to allow the craziness in North Korea to continue much longer.
We just need Dennis Rodman. Didn't he fix this?
Oh yeah. I thought he'd already taken care of this situation.
This is why we needed an NBA team.
See?
This is why it's so more crucial than ever.
See?
No one but Bill Radke could link the North Korean nuclear threat to Dennis Rodman and the return of basketball to Seattle. That was brilliant.
My work here is done.
He's a Segway king, I mean. Segway king.
Either way.
Whatever.
AOW is a week interview. Thank you. Ron Sims, you ran for governor too, as a matter of fact. Didn't you?
Oh, I did, yes.
Yeah. I think I said Rob did. You've done it all. King County executive, county council member, HUD. And Week in Review guest. You have topped it off.
Most important thing to me is I'm a grandpapa of 5 grandchildren.
Wow.
Thank you, grandpapa. Rob McKenna, former state attorney general, county council member. Thank you for coming.
Joni Balter for mayor. Bumper stickers are already available on my website.
Joni Balter for mayor, Civic Cocktail Seattle Channel. And we're out of here. Thanks for listening. Thanks, everybody.